Welcome to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. We were having too much good material off in the background, so I had to get my good friend. And let me just tell you something. I always talk about the people who I bring on the show as bringing a good friend, and they are. But Dr. Joseph is actually somebody that my daddy likes, which is a weird, I don't know if that's a weird compliment or what, but my daddy loves you and loves your writing. And he just, I told him I was doing the show, and he wanted me to tell you hello. So hello, how are you doing today?
Oh yeah, no, I love your father. You know, Dr. Cleve Sellers is a legend, and he's somebody who, you know, I've interviewed for my book on Stokely, have read multiple times The River of No Return, and again, you know, South Carolina, you know, Orangeburg, just so many different important things that your father has done. He's like, you know, he's right there with Stokely and with all the, you know, John Lewis and all those folks.
I appreciate that. There's so many unsung heroes, I think is probably the best way. Who was that over your right shoulder though?
That's my mom. My mom passed away last year. That's my late mother, Jermaine Joseph. So I have her always in the background.
What's her first name?
Jermaine Joseph.
Her first name is Jermaine?
Yeah, her first name. Yeah, she passed away last
year. Look at that. I love that name for her, and she looks elegant sitting over your right shoulder. We're gonna hop right into it though, and you've written some amazing works, which we'll get to, but first let me talk about the arc of your career since you left. Is it SUNY Stony Brook or SUNY?
Stony Brook University.
How do y'all Northerners talk about it? I mean,
yeah. So that was Rockefeller State University in New York system. And we called it SUNY. So there's SUNY Westbury, SUNY Albany, but SUNY Stony Brook. And now they've renamed it just Stony Brook University. But yeah.
SUNY. So talk about your career arc since you left SUNY Stony Brook.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I grew up in Southside Jamaica, Queens, son of two Haitian immigrants who came to the United States in 1965. And I grew up really, and I write about this in the last book, The Third Reconstruction, in the 1980s during sort of hip hop, Run DMC were right up the hill on Hempstead, but also police brutality, the murder, NYPD murder of Eleanor Bumpers, who was a 66-year-old Black grandmother when I was 12 years old. So grew up on picket lines with my mom, demonstrations, really interested in Black power, around movement people in Brooklyn and Queens and New York. And really, Stony Brook is where I met Black studies scholars and professors who are also activists, who really, Amiri Baraka was one of my professors, who really took me under their wing. And they even told me when I started school in 1990 that it would take you 5, 6, 7 years to get caught up on the story, right? And it's interesting because my mom had, like you, I grew up in an activist household. So my mom had been telling me the story, but certainly a lot of it was about Haitian history and Pan-African and the Caribbean history. And I got a deeper understanding just growing up in New York, but going to college about Black history and people like Kwame Ture and people like Angela Davis and those things. So my arc has really just been getting deeper into that whole Black power, anti-colonial, you know, Black struggle for Black dignity, like Malcolm said, or Black citizenship, like Dr. King said. So that's been the arc, and I'm in it, and I'm really, you know, grateful.
You are in it, and I want to talk to you about what's going on in Haiti right now. I mean, I talked to me about, if you are paying attention, you just saw the widow, I think they refer to it as ex-widow of the former president being indicted for the murder of the Haitian president. But what's your relationship like with Haiti, and how can we, I mean, since the early 90s, it's a country we turned our back on. What do we do? How do we repair the damage that's been caused to so many people who look like me and you?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I still have family in Haiti. So my relationship, not been able to visit because of what's going on, but deep relationship. We still send remittances, and we have our loved ones from my mother, especially tight with my mother's side. No, I mean, what we need in Haiti is a way in which where Haiti has the most NGOs. There was a point it had the most NGOs per capita in the world.
Wow.
Yet it also had the most poverty in the world, right? So what we need in Haiti really is a policy that pushes away the imperial policy that the United States has had against Haiti from jump. I mean, what's interesting is the New York Times published something recently about Haitian history and sort of the French indemnity, but also the US embargo, and the fact that it's really the Haitian Revolution that gives Thomas Jefferson the chance to get the Louisiana Purchase because the Haitians are kicking Napoleon's ass, and he has to sell that to Thomas Jefferson. But the first thing Jefferson does once we're a republic, January 1st, 1804, is do an embargo. So before the Cuban embargo, there was the Haitian embargo, and then France owes Haiti, over $50 billion just from the indemnity and the debt that they put onto Haiti, and that's connected with the World Bank, the IMF. So we need some ethical policies towards Haiti, and we need investment in Haiti, but investment that is not about people enriching themselves by taking up the best beaches and the best properties, because they always say Haiti is a really poor country, but Haiti is one of the most beautiful places on the planet Earth. It's just that the people have been marginalized from sharing in that beauty because of American foreign policy and the support of authoritarian leaders and dictators. And it's not just the Duvaliers, but it's a long, long history of supporting those kind of folks.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
You know, before we talk about the series, which is one of the reasons you're here, Genius, MLK, and X. Now, and when we talk about X, we're not talking about Elon Musk buying Twitter. I wanted to talk about your scholarship, which I'll describe. You're the scholar of Black Power Studies. I
Yeah.
describe two people like that. You and Hassan Jeffries are probably the only two people who I.
Hassan's my boy. Hassan's brilliant. Yes.
Yeah, Hassan is dope. I've known Hassan for a long time. You know, he taught at Morehouse.
Yes.
Yeah. And he used to beat up his brother, which apparently makes his brother good to be Speaker of the House. But first, what does that mean? And what does it mean to do the work you do in this moment when so many colleges and universities are seeking to eliminate the kinds of departments and programs you've committed your scholarship to as a scholar of Black Power Studies?
Well, yeah, so what Black Power Studies means is really examining a radical Black tradition that is about movements for political, economic, cultural, social self-determination in the United States and globally. So when we think about Black Power Studies, it encompasses it all in terms of radical feminist movements, whether people are liberals or socialists or Marxists. It encompasses all those things, and it encompasses them in the way in which they connect with different institutions, different social movements, and different technologies over the course of history. And the final thing I'll say, when you think about Black Power Studies, it's also an epistemological intervention. And by epistemological, that's the big word for the philosophical foundations of knowledge and knowledge production. And so instead of thinking about Black people from a European-centered perspective, we're really taking it and looking at them from not just an African perspective, but an African diasporic perspective, because none of us came off of the slave ships looking like we do. None of us. So we're all mixed and intermingled. And so it acknowledges that and acknowledges the dignity in that. And even again, Malcolm X, who's the foremost, speaker of Black dignity, it's got the red hair and the light eyes. So we're,
Yes.
come on, man, we're all in it together. So we've got to say we're not leaving anyone behind. So that's the Black Power piece. But no, the bans are something we've all faced for a long time, Bakari. We faced bans during the days of Carter G. Woodson, during the days of Ida B. Wells, during the days of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. So none of this is new. I tell my students this, none of this is new. It's just that we are a generation, and I'm Generation X, so I'm you know, older. But this is, there are some people who woke up into the struggle and thought there were certain things they weren't going to have to fight for again, you know. And all you're finding out is that, oh, whoa, I've got to fight, just like, you know, Frederick Douglass, just like Angela Davis, just like, that's the whole thing. So you're stepping into that stream of history, just like Cleve Sellers and Stokely yep. Carmichael and Dory Ladner and all these people, Joyce Ladner. I mean, you know, Gloria Richardson. There's so many different people. SNCC was a great example of this, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And even before SNCC, there was something called the Southern Negro Youth Congress that Angela Davis's parents and stuff were a part of. And that was the 1930s, and they were fighting. So all we're doing, and sometimes we say we're tired and all this stuff, but we can't afford to be tired, because all we're doing is doing what our ancestors did. That's all we're doing.
That's we could end the show right there. That's very powerful and so true. Let's talk about your new series, Genius MLKX. First, why a show about these lives in juxtaposition to one another? And can you talk about what it took you to turn your scholarship into a television show?
Sure. You know, the inspiration in a lot of ways is reading the work of James Cone and James Cone's Martin and Malcolm, which is a brilliant book from 1989. Maybe
you didn't get
paperback.
Inspiration. You didn't get inspiration from The Sword and the Shield, really?
Oh, no. It's Sword and the Shield. But I'm saying, for me, my own scholarship was certainly James Cone and reading about James Cone. And Manning Marable, Columbia University, was one of my deep mentors. And that was the first time seeing the work of both Marable, but also the work of James Cone, seeing both of them together. Although I did something different from James Cone. I made an argument, the deeper I got into looking at Malcolm and Martin and being a student of them, is that there's much more convergence than divergence. So I don't think of them as dream versus nightmare. I think of them as the dual sides of the same revolutionary coin, right? And
oh, wow.
When I think about them,
which Malcolm? Because I look at Malcolm like I look at the state of Florida.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the state of Florida, you got the country, which is the South. You got the middle part, which is touristy. And then you got the southern part, which is the most eclectic place in the world. Malcolm was layered like that. Malcolm was, and you talk about this in The Sword and the Shield. Malcolm was just, you got to figure out which Malcolm are we talking about? Because revolutionary Malcolm would slap the shit out of you. The Malcolm who died is a totally different individual.
You know, I think it's, I look at him as a holistic individual. I'm working on a book on the last year right now. And I think of him as a holistic individual, because what I have is somebody who's still interested in jazz. He's interested in culture and arts. He's interested in Islam. He's interested in revolutionary ethics. And he's also this anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist person who's willing to use the sword and the shield, right? I think that's always there. I think that's actually always there, even as he evolves. I think when I think about Malcolm, the number one contribution is this idea of dignity. Dr. King, it's citizenship. And they come to converge on that. For Malcolm, he argues that dignity is something that we're all born with. It's God-given. King is talking about citizenship, and citizenship beyond civil rights, beyond voting rights. Malcolm thinks of citizenship as just the external recognition of dignity. And why should we be thinking about getting citizenship from this racist country? Over time, especially by end of 63, even before he breaks with the Nation of Islam, you can see Malcolm pushing towards citizenship as well. He attends the March on Washington. He attends numerous demonstrations. And sometimes people say, what are you doing at the demonstration? And he says, I'm here to observe, but he's a part of the demonstration and everybody's around him in Washington, D.C., in New York City.
Talk about that. Talk about, imagine a world where you don't have a John Lewis speak. And we know John Lewis's speech prior to, you know, everybody knows what he wrote and how it was kind of rewritten for him by many of King's advisors. But imagine Malcolm X on that stage. I mean, do you even get to the I Have a Dream speech, which, by the way, is not anywhere near good oratory. I have a whole theory about the I Have a Dream speech, and I know where it was. It was not his best oratory, but imagine Malcolm X on that stage. Talk about what that would look like.
Oh, wow. Me, I don't think we would have gotten to the I Have a Dream speech if Malcolm had been able to give a speech, especially if he gave a speech like Message to the Grassroots about what a real American revolution was. And you don't come out singing, you come out swinging. I think they would have tried to stop him. Those same, the gunny sergeant who's behind King, who's clapping and everything. I think they would have. And you know, one of the things, the Justice Department, I don't think we would have seen that speech. The Justice Department had the mics ready to silence the mics if speakers said things that they weren't. So it was really Malcolm, you know, I don't agree with him completely when he says it's a farce on Washington, because I think there was real things that happened because of that day. But it was organized and set up in a way where the president and the administration didn't want to be embarrassed. And that's why John Lewis's speech has changed on the fly, because he calls out Kennedy, says, which side are you on? And then he also says, we're going to march through the South and burn through the South like General Sherman through Atlanta. We're going to burn a nonviolent army that destroys racial segregation. That was too much. And they didn't want him saying that, you know, at all. No, not at all.
What I like most about Genius is how much time the show spends talking about these men. Is you, I mean, you do a unique thing. You humanize them. They're not like Marvel characters,
No, they're not.
which a lot of people do. They're husbands, they're fathers, they're men under immense pressure, which I can identify with, to lead a movement where lots of folks weren't happy to have them be the face of it. I read the autobiography of Condoleezza Rice, and I know her father hated in Birmingham. Hated is probably not the strongest term I could use. Martin Luther King, like many people. Can you talk about the intentionality that went into showing the humanity of these men, and how in your scholarship were you able to get into the lives of these men when so many of the people with firsthand experience of them are no longer with us?
Yeah, you know, Genius, I think, you know, give a big shout out to you know, Reggie Bythewood and Gina Prince Bythewood and the whole team, Francie Calfo and all the folks at Nat Geo behind Genius. The whole point of the series and unveiling their lives was to take them out of the whole comic book iconography, because that's the whole thing. When you look at icons, people just want the big moments. And we really, in an intentional way, in the writer's room, and Damon and Raphael, the showrunners in the writers' room, went and said, "Who are these people? What are their lives? How can we get behind them and their partners, Betty Shabazz and Dr. Coretta Scott King?" So the way in which we did that, and I think in my scholarship, I've relied on oral histories and autobiographies, in addition to all the FBI and the archives and all that. So the King papers, the Malcolm X papers. Sometimes they kept notes and diaries. And we have 7 volumes of Dr. King's papers. We have all the stuff on Malcolm X. And there's a lot of people who have passed away, but who published memoirs of their times with them. So you're thinking about Jan Carew on Malcolm X, but Benjamin Kareem and Hakeem Jamal, in addition to Dr. Betty Shabazz and the autobiography. And for King, it's the same. So when you dig and dig and dig, you can find, you know, their words, their quotes, their speeches, but also some knowledge of their private thoughts too, right? To really get behind who they were. And they were both very interesting people. They were both Black men who really had deep, deep love for their families. They had deep, deep love for Black people, which is really important. I think the three qualities that combine in King and Malcolm is the personal sincerity, the political integrity, and then an unapologetic love for all Black people, but especially poor Black people. In Malcolm's case, it's people who've been incarcerated, people who are what people call, he says it in Liberator magazine in 1964. He says he wants to deal with people who are alley Negroes and gutter Negroes and people who nobody cares about. That's who he wants to. In King's case, he's sleeping on the floor of shotgun shacks in Alabama and Mississippi, and everybody talks about how he never turns away, you know, the most porous, the most the person who's in transition, the person who's got mental illness. He's just right there with you, even to the point, Bakari, where you can, I mean, that's why he gets stabbed. You can touch him, you know, and feel him, right? He's like, people don't understand with King and Malcolm X, they were rock stars. people would want to touch them. They'd come up to you, and I'm sure this happened to you with your dad. There's people who want to say, I want to feel him. I want to feel and touch. And that's who they were. So just like, you know, you got the Biden shirt on, people want to touch the president. That's who these folks were in the Black community. People wanted to touch them. People wanted to, they wanted to cook for them. They wanted to do things for them. It's an extraordinary kind of story.
What's going to happen to King's legacy after 2027? Isn't that when the FBI releases their
I think the legacy is insured because I think people are not going to buy what the FBI is selling.
They are selling a bunch of bullshit. Which...
Yeah, so I think it's insured, you know. And some people, you know, the people who believe it are people who want to believe negative things about, you know, about our icons and our heroes. But I think for somebody like me, no, because I'm not going to take what they're saying as face value. You read, there's a new 900-page book on J. Edgar Hoover by Bev Gage, which is the definitive bio on Hoover. But I mean, Hoover is not somebody to be trusted. Let's put it that way once you finish that book.
And I've actually read portions of Cleve Sellers' FBI file, so I get that. But last question for you. Well, second to last question. How important is it to tell our stories in venues that policymakers can't cancel or ban? And I ask that as a scholar who has written the kinds of books that can potentially be banned or have been banned. What did transforming that work into television mean to you to see that you've written and research and what you've written and researched become kind of living and breathing art that can't easily be taken away from us?
Oh, I've been really, really grateful and really been have real gratitude for, there's so many Black folks and other folks who've reached out and said, hey, they're watching it with their families, the whole deal. So, and it shows me the importance of art and the medium, the importance of the medium. It's things like these podcasts and television series. They travel and transport people, a bigger group of people than through books. Books are always going to be super important, but you can always reach more people through these different mediums. And in terms of the canceling, I think what's so interesting, what we have to do, Black history has always been under threat of cancellation. I think people have to wake up. I remember the Spike Lee film, if you remember School Days, wake up. Yeah. And my man, Lawrence Fishburne, wake up. People have to wake up and see, I get it. Some people for decades now, they've been living in this dream where everything's cool and they got Barack Obama or they got $1 million or they have whatever. But we're back to the mean, like this canceling and the backlash that we're facing. This is what our ancestors faced most of the time, right? And that's why we created Ebony and Jet Magazine, and we created parallel institutions. That's why we created historically Black colleges and universities, right? And so we need to, you know, get back to that, even though I get that that's really hard because that means we have to resource those institutions. And it can't be that you're saying, hey, it's going to be Apple or it's going to be some big corporation that's going to give you the resources. We have to resource that ourselves.
But last question, how can listeners find the show Genius MLKX and how can people find it and follow you on social media?
Oh, sure. You know, we can follow the show. It's Nat Geo, Disney Plus, and Hulu. It's right there available for streaming. And I'm at Peniel Joseph on Twitter. That's a tough name. P-E-N-I-E-L, J-O-S-E-P-H. So the Joseph is the Haitian, you can see. And then Peniel is also Haitian, but it's a biblical name. It's Genesis 31, where Jacob wrestles with the archangel. And it means where I've seen the face of God, yet still live.
Oh, I thought you were the archangel. Okay. All right. That makes that makes good sense.
And Instagram, Dr. Peniel Joseph. Yeah.
There you go. Peniel Joseph, the man, the myth, the legend. You are special to all of us. Thank you so much for joining the Bukari Sellers podcast. Y'all go watch this. This is amazing. Everything he does on our heroes makes them come to life, but also, I mean, in a weird way, it validates them as being our superheroes. So thank you so much.
Thank you.